Society, where we discuss real life issues in film. And today's episode, we have a real trip to Howl's Moving Castle. Yeah, we're going to Miyazaki's work. But firstly, we wanted to thank an Japanese animation, an anime content creator on YouTube, Daisy Time. She talked about us in one of her videos, and we were really grateful for her shout out, basically. So we want to give that back. So if you're into Japanese animation and you want to, you know, get some reviews, some lists that might be handy for you, and that kind of content, you can check her out on YouTube. And she has other social media that you can get by the same ad, Daisy Time. Okay, so yeah, let's get into this thirst trap that is Howl's Moving Castle. Who starts us off with the synopsis? Let's go.
Google? Do you want me to do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was, I'm gonna read one that I found on IMDb. IMDb. And it says, a love story between an 18-year-old girl named Sophie, cursed by a witch into an old woman's body, and a magician named Hal. Under their curse, Sophie sets out to seek her fortune, which takes her to Hal's strange moving castle. In the castle, Sophie meets Hal's fire demon named Calcifer. Isn't that right? This, Calcifer, isn't it? No?
Calcifier.
Yeah, Calcifier.
Yeah. Seeing that she is under curse, the demon makes a deal with Sophie. If she breaks the contract he is under with Hal, then Calcifier, right?
Yeah.
Will lift the curse that Sophie is under, and she will return to her 18-year-old shape. This was a synopsis by Sophie Ball on IMDb.
Yeah. Okay, IMDb. And actually the movie is based loosely off a book by the same name. Which the author is Diana Wynne Jones. I haven't read the book, but from what I've heard about it, it's if the movie is dark, the book is darker. So if y'all want to get a bit more info on the story and another outlook or the original outlook on it, you can check that out. To start us off, we gotta talk about character design. I mean, it's a Ghibli. I don't know how it in English.
I think it's Ghibli.
Yeah, I also think it's Ghibli. Anyway, how they do their thing like visually in such an interesting way. Yeah, I don't know if you wanna go or I can go.
I'm gonna go. You're talking.
Okay. So, you know, for a I hope the people that are here have watched the film, because there's going to be a lot of spoilers.
There's and a lot of ways.
Yeah, in-depth analysis. So, there's this witch that's the first antagonist of the movie. We say first because there's a plot point where the villain of the movie switches to an even bigger villain, that is the war. So, the witch, when she first appears, you know, she's used magic to glamour, actually, her appearance. So she's this kind of, like, shapeless being with really heavy makeup, a flamboyant wardrobe, a lot of jewelry, very, like, a very imponent persona. Mm-hmm. And this really showcases her personality and motivations as an antagonist. She's very greedy, she's very powerful, she's dangerous, and borderline inhuman with her magic. But then, she loses her magic, or rather, her magic gets taken away, and she becomes this
cute old grandma.
Cute grandma, kind of like sweet, a bit senile, needs to be taken care of. And, you know, this showcases her humanity and helplessness. And this happens exactly when the real villain of the story, the war, you know, comes to the forefront of the story. Because mm-hmm. up until this point, it was in the background. It was always there, but it was in the background. And then it switches to the front. Yeah. And, that's it's a very obvious switch in the character, not only visually but in personality wise. In Sophie, it's a bit different. It's more subdued. So, well, actually, the first switch in Sophie's appearance is a plot point. So, kind of tricky. So Sophie, in the beginning of the movie, she's really introverted. She shuts herself in. She just wants to stay in her little corner of the world. You know, we first see her in the attic of her head shop. And she's looking out on the world, but she's shut in. It's a really nice way to show how she feels. She likes to be in the world as an observer, not really interacting with it.
Yeah.
And her appearance very much shows that. She has a really simple, like, dress, very muted. Her hair is in a braid, like, not very fancy, just a normal braid. She's a hat maker, and she makes all these huge, beautiful hats. And her hat is just a plain straw hat with a ribbon, and that's it. She goes on her way with that. And she's as simple as they come. And after she has a bad encounter with the witch, which we've talked about, she's cursed, and she assumes an appearance that very much so reflects her personality, you know, very mature, but also kind of very tired of life. And so she also becomes an old lady.
Yeah.
But this curse has a nice, like, an interesting thing, because when Sophie gets vulnerable, you know, when she lets her emotions shine through, when she's brave or spontaneous or speaks her mind, we can actually see her grow younger, you know, during the film. And she never really appears exactly the same in every scene of the movie. She always has something different. And that's really cool. But, you know, when we find out that the witch has lost her magic and she sees her, she starts talking to the mastermind of the war, which is another witch. But let's talk to you know, make difference between the characters. The mastermind of the war, we can actually see her get really young again. But then her fear and her self-doubt makes her revert back to, you know, her cursed appearance. And by the end of the film, we have this really nice mix of young Sophie and old Sophie, because she finds her place. Yes, she's still very much mature for her age, and she's still very much so, you know, herself. That's part of her identity, an observer, introverted and everything. But she's also very confident and open as well by the end of the film. She grew a lot in that sense. And so her appearance, you know, she's younger, yes. Her hair is a lot shorter and more free with a lot of, like, spiky points. But her hair is still gray, like the grandma, which is a nice touch. She has a bright dress on, very flowy. It's a nice contrast. And then Howl is like a whole other journey as well, because, you know, we first meet him, he has bright blonde hair, super long, kind of hides his face, like the hair also hides his emotions, I guess, he has, like, this jacket. I love this jacket.
Yes, his style.
Bold pink and gray. He has a lot of jewelry, a huge habit of flexing on the world and flirting with every living thing. He's very flirty. He's, like, super, you know, confident. He has this, like, sort of a naive kind of aura to him. Not really naive, but
I would not say naive.
He's kind of childish in some ways.
Yeah, more childish than naive,
He acts in kind of extreme ways. Immature.
Immature. He's very, when old Sophie shows up at his place, he's just like, okay, all right, so I guess I have a person living with me now. But he doesn't really pay much attention to her. She's just there. They talk sometimes, but it's almost like, you know,
She's the maid.
She's a background. But then there's a day where he's out and she cleans the whole place. And that's a really nice metaphor for her changing their life and cementing herself in his life and his sidekick's life, like Calcifier and the kid. I don't know, the mage, like, apprentice.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name.
Me neither.
And he changes. He comes back and he's like, oh, nice, you cleaned up the house. But he doesn't show much of a reaction. But then he goes to take a bath.
Yeah.
And after a bath, oof, the melodrama. So,
oh, God.
In this moment, their whole relationship changes. He runs out of the bath, his hair is orange, then it's purple, it goes through so many colors, and then it's pitch black. And then he starts talking about his actual feelings. I think it's the first time that Howell actually talks about how he really feels. And this moment is a pivotal change. And so he starts being more giving, he shows her the flower field, gives her a lot of stuff, you know, takes Sophie.
Yeah.
Really connects with Sophie after this. And his outfit choice becomes a lot simpler. The jacket never makes a comeback. He's usually just in a white,
white shirt,
yeah, black pants, that's it. He has some jewelry because that's also part of what he is, but he's a very simple, and his hair never goes back to blonde, I think, after that.
Yeah, it's much more toned down.
Yeah, he becomes a giver in the relationship, sort of. And that's also when he starts to confront his fears slowly and trying to resolve his trauma. And there's also a really good thing in Howell and Sophie is that there's this certain gender ambiguity in them in the beginning. And I think that's about because of the way they process emotion in the beginning of the film. Because Sophie has a very masculine face, strong eyebrows, not very defined feature, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she deals with emotions is she drowns herself in practicality. So she's very subdued, very practical, closed off. She doesn't allow herself to feel, and that's stereotypically what society tells men to do as his gender. It's kind of like the male gender norm of feeling, which is not feeling, which is, you know, super toxic. But anyway.
Yeah. Men don't cry.
It's and Howell has a lot of feminine, he's generally very pretty. Long, shiny hair.
It looks like a girl. Let's just say it looks like a girl.
Yeah. he also doesn't want to show his true feelings like Sophie, but he does it differently. He hides and deflects. He hides behind this flamboyant persona, beyond the hair, the jewelry.
Yeah.
And that's how he hides himself. And that's usually how people perceive women to hide their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
It's through their makeup, through their, hiding, the way they hide their true selves is opposite to how their gender norms dictate.
Basically.
I think that's why they have that ambiguity in the design, but that's just my take on it.
Well, what I think, I mean, I never saw Sophie being really masculine.
Not really.
But like, you know, and I just think she is a part of, you know, because that's what we always say, there's the girly girls and the other girls,
mm-hmm.
right? Not true, but well. And so I think like Sophie is like the cliche of the other girl. She's like shy, reserved, cutesy, she has a thing, her passion, she makes ads. She's just like living her life simple, not wearing makeup, not being really extravagant, and nothing like that. But actually, Owl is really feminine. But I think that's another thing that is really like Miyazaki. Because I always thought that all guys in Miyazaki movies were like, they're pretty feminine in like appearance. A lot of them wear long hair. They have really feminine type of vibe going on with their face and with their, you know, really tall, slim, you know, like type of more girly girls kind of. And he uses pink, that's like girl colors. Yeah. Not really, but society. So I see the gender ambiguity in Owl as I see it in most characters, masculine. It's not masculine characters, because some masculine characters in Miyazaki movies are pretty masculine or pretty, like,
yeah,
I'll say normal, I guess.
Main characters, maybe.
Main characters usually are more like...
Yeah. I also think that, you know, Miyazaki, he... I've never heard him say that, but the relationship I have with Miyazaki films is he... All of his films have this thing of inspiring you to be true to yourself.
Mm.
And so I guess... Through the design and the animation of making characters not so stereotypical,
yeah,
with whilst still having stereotypes, kind of helps to that. So, you know, Howl, I mean, at least from my experience, everybody loves Howl and everyone has had a crush on Howl at some point. And that kind of relationship is like, you know, guys can be feminine and still be attractive and still be, you know...
Yeah.
A total fuckboy. You know, he... I guess...
Yeah, that's also
that... that normalization of fluidity in gender. Yeah. It's... I think it also goes a bit through that, I guess. Maybe I'm just overanalyzing it, but...
No.
You know, like, there's a thing in Japanese animation. In all Japanese animation. Yeah. Characters... tends to be a lot more feminine, like the way they draw their faces and things like that. You'll never see a really square jaw and strong features, strong eyebrows, strong eyes, like really, like, you know, never see really the, it's more like gentle and cute, and you can see this in almost every type of Japanese animation. So I think it comes not only from the norm there, because beauty norms there, yeah, maybe like they like guys a little bit
more gentle
than like in the West. We're pretty masculine and we're like
jacked
and super tall and super thing, and maybe they just are more into the like a guy that's more lanky, there's more a bit more feminine, more gentle, more kind. It will look more kind.
Yeah,
I feel that. So yeah, but clearly with the Owl, it's exaggerated a bit. Yeah. I think the blonde hair really
makes him more feminine. Yeah,
and the blue eyes.
Ponyo as well is a bit exaggerated.
In the father.
Yeah. The father is actually very feminine.
Yeah, wears makeup and heavy makeup.
He was also the. Like, Ponyo's dad, I read somewhere that he was, the character design was inspired by David Bowie.
Yeah.
So ooh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I saw a review that also tied Howl to that a little, but, you know, we'll talk about it a little more. And so, this movie has a, you know, when we first started to think about talking about this one, we were like, is there really, I mean, obviously there's always a lot to talk about Miyazaki's films, but is there really something for us, you know, for what we strive to talk about?
Mm-hmm.
But once we got into that, we were like, oh wow, there's so many things here. So the whole movie is actually Miyazaki's response to the Iraq War, which he was deeply against. I found that out while researching for this. So... Which, it's super funny because this was nominated for an Academy Award and it's basically a criticism against American politics, but, you know, America, am I right?
They didn't notice.
Yeah, no, they just thought, oh yeah, we have to put a Japanese animation movie in here.
That could be nice. Let's go.
Yeah, this one is
and
nice.
So, yeah, this, this is really, I found a lot about this part of the anti-war. There's also a lot of things that involve the power of compassion and pacifism in this film. But yeah, you know, about the war part, the movie focuses a lot on the victims of the war and not on the motives of it. Just the only justification of the war that we get is like, oh, you know, some prince has been kidnapped or has disappeared, so let's bomb this whole place up, basically. And this vagueness of information and withholding regarding the war, it's really cool because it emphasizes the uselessness and futility of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, so somebody disappears and now we're bombing everything? What's happening? And the political maneuvering of the elite renders the public as collateral damage and discredits justification for the conflict. Is just, this happened, so we have every right to destroy everything, and whatever damage we make is plausible. You know, that's what the political maneuvering in this film is, and in most wars, but well. And, you know, at the end of the movie, this futility of war is really interesting because a lot of people criticize this abrupt ending, but, you know, the war ends very abruptly. We discover that the prince was cursed, and he was a scarecrow that we met in the beginning that had been following Sophie along and was just in the background. We don't really pay much attention to it. Make some funny gags, like physical gags now and then, but that's all. And when he breaks his curse, he's like, I'm gonna go to my home country and I'm gonna end this war. And then when he goes, the mastermind of the war is like, okay, yeah, you're back. Let's stop the war. This is such a happy ending. But this happy ending is like filled with bombings. There's a lot of destruction. You know, Sophie's hometown is in ashes, and suffering and most likely death of a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people say, oh, this is so abrupt. The war ended so like in that moment, and it's not really closure. But, you know, that's the thing about war. It never really ends.
Yeah.
So that's why it's so genius that they did it so, you know, it's almost childish. And it really is. And the way it explores that is really cool because it doesn't make it exciting. It's not appealing. It's not like an action adventure thing. No, it's wrong, and that's it. The war is wrong. That's everything you take away from that movie. People that have nothing to do with it suffer, and that's the thing. The movie puts us in the place of the humans that suffer from it, the consequences and the destruction. So, you know, François Truffaut, he said something along the lines of, like, it's impossible to make a truly anti-war film because by showing the process of it, you're making it appealing and you're romanticizing war. And I think this film finds a solution for that. Because
I don't think so.
Wow. Let me just finish this thought and you can... since we are positioned in the destruction, in the consequences, the afterthought of that Miyazaki puts in this is that war, no matter which one, violence, is measured in its destruction and not in its justifications, which means there's no justification for war. And I think that's a really great way to go about talking about war, you know? But, I mean, that's just my...
Well, I don't really agree that this is the solution because I still think it pretty much romanticized war. Because, I mean, movie romanticized life, right? This is what it's about, movie. It doesn't always make it a good thing, of course, but it romanticized it. It shaped it into a form of entertainment. And and I do think that more than an entire war theme that is like that you can see in every Miyazaki movie, basically in all his filmography, you see that war is bad, don't do war. I think that this hand, like the prince just going back to his hometown or to his country and just be like, yeah, let's hand it, and people be like, yeah, let's hand it, is to show more like of the futility of the USA government that makes basically most of wars around the world right now. And they just be like, okay, there's no more interest in there, so let's get back home and just leave the places with total destruction and people there fighting with each other, and they just be like, I'm out, goodbye, just like solve the things on your own. And not only like USA, but like Western countries that take, you know, parts in worldwide wars, like really far away from their homes. They'd be like, yeah, let's make war there, like there where they cannot touch us. And the thing that anti-war type of message is really, really logical in Japanese culture. Because of the bombings of, you know,
nuclear bombs.
So this is a theme that you can find in a lot of movies, not only Miyazaki's, but a lot of Japanese animation. And usually they, you know, it's like the feeling for Portuguese with the people that goes lost in the sea. It's the same feeling that they have with people that die in bombings, yeah. Basically. It's the same type of feeling that is really true to their cultural backgrounds. And there is this movie in this corner of the world that talks about the bombings, like, literally. And it is much more efficient, I think, than Owl's Moving Castle to show, like, distress in the people. Because even if we are with Sophie and Owls, that are the people, Owls take part in the the war, he fights in it because he needs to, and Sophie, we only see Sophie suffer directly from it when she's back in the
in her hometown,
because when she just like going around with them, we do not really see the impact of what we hear. The impact that it is having there, and we see like ships go in, and we just be like, oh, damn, war, but it's just like background, you know, and we don't really see what it does to the people.
Yeah, that's also due to the fact that the war as protagonist only comes to the forefront in the middle of the film. I don't know if that's really. If that was what he intended, to, you know, so you only really understand in this movie the consequences and the pressure that war creates once it's on you, and if that's the message he also wants to bring, or if that's just, you know.
I feel that there's the old anti-war theme, like, you know, we can see it pretty much everywhere, and even from the beginning, like, because they're military
everywhere,
basically. but we only feel the consequences of it when we see that scene with Sophie when she's back in the shop, and it's really brief. You know, and it does not allow us to suffer with her. We just like, oh my God, what is happening? Bombings, oh Jesus, she's in danger, and then poof, it's gone.
Yeah.
So I think, it is an anti-war movie, but it does not put us in the people's shoes.
Yeah, the for instance, Grave of the Fireflies, I think it doesn't romanticize the bombing, it's quite real and raw. And another an interesting thing that I found about what you were talking about, the fact that what triggers the war is something so nonsense and not really explained, it's a portrayal of not only the war nowadays, but what triggers people to have discussions and fights. It can only be just a word or a phrase, something that was taken out of context,
yeah, or misunderstood. Some, yeah.
And that could lead to a whole lot of problem just because maybe we're overthinking it or taking too much out of it. And it's quite interesting to see that. And it's a bit sad because this movie isn't recent and it already talks about the future and how we still deal with things.
It does not have time. It talks about the past, present, the future, and because it talks about our own nature. We are conflictuous, like we are conflictuous, all of us. We all enter conflict, and when it gets to measures that are like all too big for us to understand, it can lead to pretty disastrous things.
Yeah, because we are scared and we don't know how to deal with
them. Yeah, but we started it. It didn't start like alone. We started it for some reason. But I don't know why.
That's so stupid.
Interests, I guess.
Yeah, thinking that, oh, we're scared about this. So to be have a defensive kind of way to deal with things, we're going to make it even worse and scare other people in the way.
Yeah.
That's we do not know how to postpone to war without war.
Yeah.
And that's you know, one of the things I like, especially we don't see that much. Howl learns it a bit, but the person that I always see as a pacifist and very full of compassion is Sophie in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, that one of the climax of the film when the witch that's now an old senile grandma, when she takes calcifier and she's trying to kill calcifier. She's, you know, she's not even thinking, she's just trying to crush him. And Sophie, she has enough strength to just rip calcifier out of the witch's hand and be done with it. But no, she cries, she talks, she appeals to her. She doesn't force a solution. She talks it out. She tries, you know, it's way harder to solve a conflict that way.
Yeah.
But she does it because it's the right way. It's a lot better to keep it solved, to, you know, put an end, a final stop to that and, you know, talk it out, find a solution, a real solution, than just rip it by force. And then, you know, 20 minutes later, you have another problem to deal with.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a lot of other scenes where she shows that kind of compassion, but I feel like that scene is great because she's suffering so much from that, you know, the person she loves is dying, and she's but she still tries to be rational about it. She tries to do the best for everyone. Not only is she solving the fact that, you know, Hal might die. But she's also solving the anger and the hurt that the witch still has with Howl and with the world. And I feel like that's a very beautiful thing to see.
Yeah, and that another scene that I really like that you talked about earlier, when Howl has his little accident with his hair color, he throws a big tantrum. And I think that something that we can see disturbs Sophie along the movie is the fact that she's acting like a maid, treating the house and calcifier and everyone in it. And Hal just comes and goes and doesn't say a word, and she wants to have a moment to talk with him. And when he throws his big tantrum, he spends days closed in his room. And the other inhabitants of the house are saying like, oh, don't go in there, he needs his time, don't go, it will only make it worse. And she goes and talks to him, and that's what makes it better, right? Am I, no? Yeah?
Yeah, you're right.
And I really like that.
She goes in there, and that's when he asks her to go see the
field of poppies.
Yeah.
Is it poppies? I think it's poppies.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and that's you know, that's the switch in their relationship.
Yeah.
Because
I really love that scene.
You know, Sophie needed to find someone like Howl to learn that her practicality is might be, you know, since she's an introvert, she can see how practicality and shutting off, because Howl also shuts off the world, how bad it can be for other people. And she tries to reach out first because she can sensed that, and Howl needed someone to make him realize that him trying to be everything, every single second of the time for everyone is not healthy for him or for others. They're basically each other's therapists.
Yeah.
And that's something we talk about, actually, on another topic that's about their personalities. And, you know, this movie is really cool, and in the sense that it's not a coming-of-age film.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie about people, of adults, that aren't ready to be adults or don't want to be adults. And it's really nice to see that portrayed, you know, because when I was 17, 18, I'm not an adult, by the way, today either. So, like,
a young adult.
I'm on the journey to become one still.
Technically,
but
teenage years just stops at 25, just saying.
Yeah, oh, but really? Oh, no.
I went through this weird phase when I was like 17. Not weird, but where I was really scared of turning 18. 18 is the legal age in our country. And yeah, I was so scared. And I didn't really think I had a rational reason to be scared. But I just,
it's just one more year.
Yeah, it's not that big of a deal. But, you know, the fact that people were talking about all these responsibilities, yeah, that I would have and all these expectations, how they would double and how I was supposed to act and how I was supposed to be, it put such a big pressure, and I was super scared of turning 18. And then when I did, I was like, well, I don't feel any different.
Is it?
I mean, I guess it depends from experience to experience, because, like, you know, we like are forced to grow up at 18 legally,
mm-hmm,
because we need to vote. Yes, we need to vote.
Yeah.
We have to vote.
Vote!
But, you know, and we became, like, basically, I don't know, we are responsible of our own selves. That wasn't the case before. But I guess it depends a lot on how you grow, because a lot of people don't feel this pressure. And a lot of people feel this pressure much earlier on. I felt that I was forced to become an adult, no, but to grow up really faster when I was around 15, 16, because, you know, everything, like, I moved and everything just shifts for me, and I felt the pressure to fill in the shoes, my parents' shoes, you know, and for my brother, for me, for everything, because I felt that was what I need. And I think that Sophie, that is pretty young, she is 18 in the movie, right?
Yeah.
It's the same thing. She is the same thing. I don't think that she needed to grow now. I think that she was forced to grow before, mm-hmm, even the movie starts,
and
because
now she doesn't
our
want
sisters work in a restaurant or whatever. I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And her mom, the owner, yeah, of the shop, is always away.
Yeah, and she is lonely. She is alone there, and she needs to take care of everything by herself. She needs,
yeah,
to take care of herself, the shop, the hats, everything. She does it all alone. And so she is in the war. Like, you know, it's a situation where, like, you could die the next morning. And, yeah, you need to deal with all the stuff, all the things going on. And so she was pretty much forced to grow up before coming of age, and so that's why she was already so you know, so closer to the rest of the world, because she needed to. It was
yeah,
the only way she could survive,
yeah,
to everything.
She doesn't like being an adult because she was forced to be one too early.
Yeah.
And so that's why she basically, she wants to skip adulthood. She wants to go straight into the wisdom of old age, where she doesn't have to care anymore.
Yeah.
She has passed the difficulties. She's just chilling. And Howl still wants to grow, still needs to grow up. So
yeah,
he wants to remain behind. He wants to remain in the potential of growing up, in the adolescence. And that, and we can see that they're both scared of the same thing, but they deal with them very differently. And they come from very different backgrounds. And, you know, there's a whole, like, arc of things where this gets resolved and everything. But in the end, I guess they both realize growing up, because, you know, they have a lot of bad examples of adulthood around them. Don't we all, am I right? Toxic behavior, gossiping, greed, big egos, war, violence, misogyny, all that stuff. And they do not identify. They don't want to be that. So they're like, I don't want to be this adult. I don't want to be an adult. I don't want to go through that. I don't want to turn into this. And I guess what their relationship with adulthood changes when they realize they can manage being adults while being true to to themselves.
Yeah.
By changing their perception of things, like of what a family is, what kind of life they want to live, you know, and they need to always evaluate and consciously evaluate their needs, the needs of others, and just, you know, do their best at being their best selves, I guess.
Well, I think ours is as the opposite response that's Sophie's, you know, like, Sophie, like, was forced to grow up, and so she grew up. How was forced to grow up, and he didn't.
Yeah.
And you can see that in the fact that before Sophie comes in, he is...
doesn't take care of the house.
Like, the house is disgusting, and his only friend is a literal child, you know, that take care of the things around as much as, if not more, than Owl. You know, and it's just like, well, I need to grow up, but I'm not, because I don't know how to do it. I'm not ready yet.
I just remembered who the child was, the one that transforms into a
funny person. Yeah.
And, you know, even that child has a relationship with adulthood. The kid, you know, Howell doesn't do it, you know, on purpose, but the child kind of becomes a manager of the thing, and he's forced to man up. But then when Sophie comes along, you know, even the kid, he realizes he needed someone. He needed a parental figure. And Sophie, and then later on, Howell, become that for him as well. And he gets
a granny too, because...
And he gets to be a child.
That's true.
And he gets to be a child. And this, the way they build their unconventional little family and the way they want to live really goes in with this idea that, you know, adulthood, the rules of adulthood aren't set in stone, and you know, you don't have to follow this. It might be hard, of course it's hard to go against the current, but if you don't feel identified by that sort of adulthood, I mean, I sure as hell don't, you can build your own adulthood according to what you need. And I guess that's one of the messages as well that Miyazaki tries to send us, is that, you know, be true to yourself, be your own adult, be, you know, things are scary when you don't see yourself in them, but that doesn't mean you have to be exactly that, I guess.
Yeah, no, once more, this movie really goes straight into problems that we are facing nowadays.
Yeah.
The thing about, you see each more and more young people who are going into adulthood, like us, choosing their own paths and fighting their own causes. And that's kind of provoking to adults who had to live a certain way their whole life and are watching young people do things their own way and talking about problems they thought didn't exist and ignored for years, like the thing about climate change, the thing about racism that should have been gone years ago and
should never been.
Yes,
should have never been a thing.
It should have never existed, and it's still here, it's still with us. And mainly, I'm not blaming the adults, because we change the way we view the world. The world changes on how it shows us things. And it's all about, again, the way we are educated, the way we see things, the way we educate ourselves.
Yeah.
That's also really important. And I think this movie teaches that as well. Another thing I found really interesting about that when Sophie gets cursed, she's like, oh, well, I'm going to have to live like an old lady, I guess. Yeah.
And it's almost a relief for her.
Yeah.
Before I forget, I'm sorry. Just to cite our source, I remember now. Because the thing about this thing about growing old and adults that don't want to be adults, if you want to like have a more treated analysis on this topic of Howl, and you know, it was a video we found that was really interesting, and we wanted to bring up these topics that this person brought up. So if you want to get more on that, you can go on YouTube. The user Follow the Moon Rabbit has a video called Howl's Moving Castle, a film about adults that don't want to be adults. And yeah, you can check that out for a better, I guess, a more chronological explanation. A more
organized
thought. Yeah, a more organized thought on this. But yeah, we're just throwing it. But yeah, sorry, keep going.
Yeah, she goes into the house and she's like, well, this house is a mess. So yeah, I'm the maid you didn't know you hired. And Howl treats her that way in a nice way, but goes, like I said earlier, he comes and goes to the house and is like, oh yeah, you did this and that. And at one of the moments of the movie where I'm a hopeless romantic, so
yeah.
I found that really cute because I was frustrated the whole movie, like, oh, is she going to be old forever? I want them to be together. She can be old because it doesn't fit.
It doesn't fit. Yeah,
and when we find out that when she goes to sleep, during the sleep time, she goes back to her young self, and Howl sees that, it's like, and she, I think she realizes that one time, and her reaction is like, oh no, like, not only I didn't want you to see my true self, but my young self, because it's like, it's as if it destroys. As if it destroyed her whole construction she had to do to show him that she was a wise old woman and that she's not the child she appears to be.
And it's because I don't know if y'all remember, but Sophie never admits once that she is beautiful.
She has
zero confidence. Yeah. She has like super low self-esteem, and so she's so much better in a physique that is not like
supposed
to be appealing, because like, well, it's a whole lady. She's
lived.
She has seen things, you know. So
shout out to all the old ladies that have seen things.
Y'all have seen things.
I love you, Grandma.
I'm never gonna stop loving you, Grandma.
But yeah, so she feels a lot more comfortable in a body that of a person that people would not expect a certain type of
beauty.
Yeah, beauty, but not only beauty, effort to be beautiful.
Yeah, goddamn.
Goddamn, that's so deep. Deep,
yo, real deep.
Yeah, but
we go in 6 feet under, like.
Because Sophie struggled, and we see that struggle right at the beginning of the movie, because she only sees herself as the hat maker, and she makes hats for beautiful ladies who show up dressed like ladies.
Ladies.
Quote unquote. I'm sorry, like, Joey doesn't friends. The quotey thing.
The quotey.
Because, again, it's not real ladies. We go into that whole society.
The, like,
view
the cliche of a lady. The femme fatale.
The female gaze. The female gaze that men have, not the our gaze.
Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah, and because of that, she hides herself in her little room of making hats and doesn't see herself as one who could be wearing those hats. Oh, that's a cute thing to say. Beautiful.
And, when we get to the ending shot, there's this really nice yin-yang thing with them both. Oh,
that's so beautiful.
Because, you know, Sophie still has her gray hair, but it's short and wild and everything.
They complete each other.
Yeah, it's bad. And they were roommates.
Flying or or something that's, you know, I remember flowing hair.
Yeah, because they're yeah.
They're so in the balcony of the castle.
Oh my god, that's it. That's so beautiful.
Basically, this movie is, and they were roommates, and they were forced to have to go through therapy together.
Yeah.
And oh my god, yeah, and you, as audience, have... You sort shit out as well. Yeah, you go through through therapy with this movie as well. Through therapy. Yeah. So, yeah. The therapy of Howl's Moving Castle, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you don't... Wait. Just so I can say it and it can go... The witch... / the granny is my favorite character. Just saying, because she's like, first, like, she's really like, oh my god, how dare you look at Howl, he is mine.
Yeah,
boof, now you're old. Goodbye. And then she's just like, well, now I'm just a cute old granny and I'm a little bit crazy. Deal with me.
Yeah. Can you bring me my soup?
Give my blankie.
Yeah, it's great.
So cute.
I forgot what I was going to say. Ah, you don't have to pay. Maybe only, no, to see on Netflix you have to pay. So.
Oh, yeah.
But you don't have to pay that much to have your own type of therapy because you have that free on Netflix with this movie.
Watch the movie you and you'll be just like... Mm-hmm.
Honestly, want to go through therapy in film? Watch all of Studio Ghibli's films.
Yeah. Oh, God.
All of them, you're going to have a great
it's a great emotional discharge that you go through with these movies, I think.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see how the movies from that studio really... make us go back into phases of life or make us think about...
Even Porco Rosso.
Yeah, even Porco Rosso. Even My Neighbor the Yamadas. I think all of them.
But I mean, Porco Rosso is just like so funny.
Because who would have thought...
Yeah, that a movie about a flying pig would be like deep.
Yeah, it's wild. It's wild. Miyazaki, but props to you, dude.
Yeah, that's the magic of animation and knowing how to tell a story through animation.
It's so, like, yeah, animation has so much more fantasy than normal fiction has.
But because, still... Like,
you know, you can do so much... No, it's not that you can do so much more with animation, but you can make people accept so much more things.
Si. I was going to say yes, and I said
well, it's okay.
This was so natural.
The Portuguese flag appears. It's okay.
It was so fucking natural. Luna,
y'all know what you need to do in this one.
I'm so sorry.
I'm fucking crying.
Oh my god. But, yeah, I mean... With this patriotic response,
I think we're gonna end it.
Yeah, we can end the episode here. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for following us. You can find all our links on our link tree, available on our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A lot of stuff. We have a lot of stuff. Go shut up!
I'm trying.
We have a lot of stuff planned and coming soon. We hope. We'll keep you updated on our social networking. And we hope you like this.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.